You're listening to the Cycling Podcast in association with Rafa. Rafa exists to improve your ride with the finest kit, inspiring stories, and vibrant clubhouses across the globe.
Hello, my name's Richard Moore, and on this week's podcast, I'm joined by our old friend Fran Reyes.
Hello, sweet Richard of mine. Hello, dear listeners.
Fran, where are we?
We are in Barbate, one of the many beautiful coastal towns here in Cádiz, southeast of Andalucía.
What is this town famous for?
Here in Spain, this town is famous for two things. One is unemployment, which is a very big problem here. And the other one is drug smuggling, because a lot of hash enters via this beach.
Wonderful. I want a great location then for the final stage of the Ruta del Sol, which is, we've been on the race coming and going a little bit. You were at the start of the race, I've been at the end of the race, been staying down the coast here in a very nice little holiday village. But Fran, what I've learned this week about Andalusia is it's very, very big. It's bigger, I'm told, by one of our colleagues, than Austria.
Yes, it is. I mean, it is more or less the size of Portugal. That means that there is a very big difference between the western corner of Andalusia, which is where we are right now, and the eastern corner, which is where I was born.
And where the race sort of started or was in the first couple of days.
Yeah.
We've seen an interesting race, a good race. We're speaking as the final time trial is underway. The Tim Wellens is in the leader's jersey, and a fairly good bet, I would think, to hold on to that lead. He won the penultimate stage yesterday, a beautiful little hilltop finish. Where were we yesterday, Fran?
Well, yesterday I was in Pamplona, in the presentation of Equipo Lizarte. Pamplona is more or less the other corner.
Yeah, but where was the race?
The race was in Alcalá de los Gazules. It's a small town here in Cádiz, in the Grazalema Sierra.
And it was a really stunning finish up a cobbled climb. Wellens, of course, knows the cobbled climbs from Belgium. I spoke to him quickly at the finish he said at the start of the week he was here for stage wins and wasn't interested in GC and didn't think he would be capable of much in the time trial. His thoughts have changed now, obviously. And here's what he had to say after winning yesterday's stage ahead of Mikel Landa, among others. Tim, do you find yourself leading the race almost by accident?
Not really by accident. So I knew the second day I had a really good finish, really good legs. So I knew the condition was fairly good. And also this morning, you know, yesterday I looked at the parcours from today and I knew that the climb of today was really nice for me. And I took the chance that I had.
Did you know the cobbled finish? Did you know much about it?
Yesterday I was pretty long on my computer looking at the finish. So it was worth to do a good research. And I knew the final climb because I looked it up. With really good legs like today, it's really perfect climb. Also, the fact there are cobbles and you can ride next to the cobbles with a small part of asphalt, it's really good for me. I was doubting to let a little gap, so he thought that I was dead, so that he kept riding. But I was afraid to let too much of a gap that he went away. But then in the final 350 meters, I went full and I was a little bit stronger than Landa today. So now I'm really motivated for the TT. It's a special TT. I'm not really a specialist, but the fact that it's not a normal TT because it's on gravel roads, maybe it's better for me. So of course I have a chance to win the GC. It's not every day that you ride on gravel roads on TT, so maybe that's a little bit different. So we will know tomorrow.
So that was Tim Wellens. I played that before Lionel's news roundup because Lionel will tell us in his news roundup. I'm about to hand over to him now whether Wellens did indeed hang on. We don't know yet. Over to you, Lionel.
Thank you, Richard. Yes, Tim Wellens did indeed hold on to win the Ruta del Sol for the Lotto Soudal team. He won overall ahead of Wout Poels of Sky by 8 seconds, with Marc Soler of Movistar in third place. Wellens set up his victory by taking stage 4. It's been a controversial week for Team Sky, a lot of spotlight on Chris Froome, but it's also been a very good week for them in terms of winning races. Wout Poels and David de la Cruz won stages in southern Spain. Meanwhile, across the border in Portugal, at the Tour of the Algarve, where there was a very strong field, the honours were basically split between Sky and Dylan Groenewegen. The Dutch sprinter won 2 stages for Team Lotto NL Jumbo, and that tally was matched by Mikael Kwiatkowski, who won the overall ahead of his teammate Geraint Thomas. Thomas had earlier led the race and won the time trial. TJ Van Garderen had a good early result for BMC Racing. He took third place on the podium. In the Middle East at the Tour of Oman, Astana did the 1-2 as well. Alexei Lutsenko won the race with his teammate Miguel Angel Lopez in second place. Lopez won the Queen stage on Green Mountain, and there were also victories for Nathan Haas, that was his first in Katusha colours, Greg Van Avermaet, Magnus Cort Nielsen and Alexander Kristoff. Meanwhile, there was an unusual disqualification for Adam Blythe of the Aqua Blue team during stage 6 of the Tour of Oman. The British rider had a problem with his bike and wanted to swap, but because the team cars are supplied by the organisers and the bikes are fitted on racks with the front wheel out, it posed a bit of a problem. Aqua Blue are using disc brakes and the DS wanted to go ahead of the peloton to prepare the bike ready for Blythe to swap. So far so good. Unfortunately though, Blythe took the bike from the side of the road rather than from the team car behind the bunch, which is against the rules, and he was disqualified. We'll probably try and find out a bit more about that story in the coming weeks. Finally, Frenchman Jonathan Hivert of Direct Energy won the two-day Tour du Haut Var after winning both stages. Alexis Villemoz was second and Thibaut Pinot got his season underway with fifth place overall. Back to you in Spain, Richard.
The big story all week, of course, has been the participation of Chris Froome with his salbutamol case, his adverse analytical findings still unresolved. There was a report at the start of the week that in Gazzetta dello Sport that it was going to be referred to the UCI Anti-Doping Tribunal. I asked him about that. Don't think there was... Well, there hasn't been any further news on that, so I don't know whether any movement is imminent or not. There's been a lot of media here, a lot more media here than usual, obviously covering Froome, and Froome has been saying more or less the same things every day. I sat down with him this morning before the time trial to ask him some of my own questions, and we'll hear from him in a moment. But Fran, this is your home race, and it has been a bit of a circus at times, hasn't it, with Froome riding and a lot of people feeling that he shouldn't be riding.
There's been a lot of media here, which this race is usually gets good coverage. There is a handful of journalists here, quite different to many other Spanish races where I am the only journalist attending. But in this case, the coverage has been increased and multiplied maybe for three, because there has been about 150 journalists here accredited. It was pretty curious to see in the start village of the first stage in Mijas, which was located in the outskirts of the town, the start, so there wasn't a lot of public, but there was a lot of media. There were way more journalists than fans, and all the journalists were waiting outside the Team Sky bus for Chris Froome to appear. And it was curious to see the rest of the riders just turning their heads to see the Team Sky bus and wonder whether he had gone out or not. You know, it was the only story that day. And yeah, to be honest, I don't see the point of chasing Froome every day to asking questions, because after all, there are not a lot of things to discuss right now other than what he has already said.
It was interesting that Jakob Fuglsang was one of the riders who was critical of the fact that he was riding. He then seemed to change his tune having spoken to Froome. Froome obviously told him something that made him see it in a slightly different light. I think from speaking to people at Team Sky, there's a lot that Froome can't say at the moment. You know, legal advice is not to maybe share some information that might, as I say, shed a bit more light on it. I think within Team Sky, it's a very unpleasant experience that they're going through, and Froome in particular is going through. But I've been quite surprised at the sense I have of confidence that he will be cleared, you know, because I think for a lot of us observers, we don't really see that. We don't share that optimism that they have, because we're aware of precedents of salbutamol cases in the past which have led to anti-doping bans, but we don't know how many cases there have been that haven't.
Yeah, I mean, after all, the closer case, the closer precedent is that of Diego Ulisi, had the same amount of salbutamol and got a 9-month ban, which isn't exactly a clearance. I mean, getting a 9-month ban from Froome, retroactively counted, of course, would allow him to ride the Tour de France, but still, he wouldn't be able to ride the Giro. That would disrupt his season heavily.
Well, I think that's up for debate, Fran. I think that the you know, we're comparing here with the Contador case, where he accepted the loss of results in exchange for a band starting earlier. I'm not sure that would be the case with Froome, but you know, it might be that a band starts from the date of the decision rather than being backdated.
It's interesting, and it's, you know, it's something that, as you said, we don't know at this point. The only thing, the only interesting quote that Froome gave away in that first stage media scrum was that when we learned the facts as he saw it, we would change perspective. As you say, that's maybe the reason for Team Sky's confidence on his clearance, or at least on getting sanction that wouldn't be that big of a punishment. But at this point, we are more or less in the dark.
Well, to try and come into the light a little bit, I spoke to Chris Froome this morning and I asked him a few questions. I'd seen him 3 weeks after he knew about his adverse finding, and obviously I didn't know at the time he knew, and I was surprised looking back on that how relaxed he was, so I asked him about that. But here he was speaking before the time trial. A lot of people have the view that you shouldn't have raced here. Was it ever in your mind to not race here? Was it a tough decision? Was it a dilemma that you faced?
This isn't a normal set of circumstances. This is a difficult situation. I can fully understand both sides of it and the whole debate there. But yeah, in my mind, it was very clear that racing would be the right thing to do. I think especially coming from a point that I know I've done nothing wrong. So I think it would have been very difficult for me not to have started the season as planned.
You've mentioned that there are lots of other riders been in a similar situation. I mean, how do you know about them? Have riders told you personally, or is it just something that's known within the sport?
Yeah, quite a few people have contacted me personally since my case became public and said that they'd been through something very similar themselves. But yeah, I mean, obviously I'm not able to go into any details about their specific cases or anything like that. But also not just in cycling. We are at this point doing absolutely everything we can to try and get this resolved as fast as possible. And I mean, I don't want this to go on any longer than it should.
I saw you, of course, when you'd known about it for about 3 weeks, and I guess looking back on that, I'm surprised at how relaxed you appeared. How did you feel when you heard, you know, when you were told, which I think was in Bergen, wasn't it? But what was your response?
I mean, initially it was obviously quite a shock initially. Once I came to terms with it, I thought, okay, this will be something that I imagine would have been sorted out much faster than it was. It is a pity that we are into the racing season again, but I do understand that it's a much, much more complicated process than I initially thought, and I've got all the confidence that we are going to get to the bottom of it and we are going to get it sorted out, but it is going to take time.
It appears business as usual, certainly in your training and your racing now, but are you worried? I mean, are there moments where you fear, you know, a potential ban? Is that something that you worry about?
No, I mean, it's not something that I'm going to necessarily waste energy thinking about and labouring on. I mean, I'm going to plan for the best case scenario here. And obviously coming from that standpoint that I haven't broken any rules, I haven't done anything wrong, I'm not even going to entertain that in my mind.
Going back to that third week in the Vuelta, I mean, how much were you suffering? You've in the past suffered in the third week with bronchial problems, chest problems. Yeah. Was that the case there, and how bad was it, and how did it compare to previous years?
Yeah, I mean, I was getting quite chesty in that last week of the Vuelta. I mean, anyone who saw me at the finishes, I had a lot of journalists asking, are you sick? Are you weak? Are you open to your rivals? Are they going to be attacking you now that they can see there's you're not quite at your best anymore? So I mean, people could recognize that I was having difficulty breathing over those finish lines in those last few days of the Vuelta. But I mean, it's not the first time that I've had sort of issues like that coming towards the end of a grand tour. I think, I mean, obviously your body's on the limit and immune system's probably a little bit low, and that's for me, I guess that's my Achilles heel.
So what's next, Chris, after this?
Straight up to Tenerife next week. Do a big block of training ahead of Tirreno Adriatico. Just obviously try and get my mind focused on what I need to do to try and move the condition on a little bit. I mean, I'm pretty happy with how I'm feeling here at Ruta for a start and for a sort of first hit out, if you like. But I know I've got a lot of work to do, and yeah, I mean, Tenerife is a great place to be able to do that. There are no distractions, and just crack on and really, really just push on in the training training side of things.
There was a report, Gazzetta dello Sport in the week, that the UCI were going to refer the case to the anti-doping tribunal. You've not had any notification of that, I understand.
There's a lot of very incorrect information that's been published in the media. I mean, it's not something I'm going to go case by case trying to address each one and trying to correct every single bit of information out there. I think it'd be a full-time job for anyone who's trying to do that, the amount of misinformation that's been out there. So I think I just have to kind of push all that aside and just try and stay focused on the goal at hand.
Chute à l'arrière du peloton, Cycling Podcast team car at the back of the pack, please.
That reminds us to tell you that the Cycling Podcast is sponsored this week by the Lisa Mattress. It's the new way to buy a mattress. You don't need to go to a store. You can order the Lisa Mattress online and have it delivered to your door, compressed in a box. So there's no more awkward, time-consuming bed shopping experiences. Lisa gives you 100 nights to try your mattress at home, risk-free. And if you're not sleeping better within 100 nights, Lisa will pick up your mattress and donate it or recycle it and arrange a full refund for you. I've had my Lisa mattress for a couple of weeks now, and there's absolutely no way that I'm returning it. It really is very comfortable. Giving back is an important part of the Lisa brand too. One mattress is donated to charity for every 10 that are sold. We've got an exclusive discount code for our listeners. You can receive £80 off a Lisa mattress with the code cycling. Go to lisa.co.uk, that's LEESA.co.uk, and enter the code cycling to receive £80 off your purchase. The Lisa mattress, a better place to sleep.
The Cycling Podcast is supported by Science in Sport. Science in Sport, fueled by science.
Did you have many updates on the course, Tim? Did you know how you were getting on compared to your rivals?
Actually, very, very late. I understand I was in front of Vogelsang, but that was the only thing I knew, so I wasn't really aware of the times. So in the beginning of the week, I said that the first place is the only important thing here. If you're second or third on the Route del Sol, nobody remembers. So the winner is perfect, and now that I won the Route del Sol, I'm very happy with this.
Tim, your boss, Marc Sargeant, won this race 36 years ago. Did you know that? Have you been speaking to him this week?
He was here in the beginning of the week. He visited us, and he comes every year to the Route del Sol because he won here 2 times, actually. And yes, he said that he won here, and he has a special relationship with the old organization of this. So every year he comes back to visit.
Now, Tim, you ended the season last year very strongly. You've started this season very strongly. Did you just keep working hard over the winter? Is that the secret?
I think so, but I really noticed that I've put another step forward, and I really, really feel the power in the legs. I do things that I couldn't do last year, so it's happy to ride like this.
I mean, one of those things is matching somebody like Mikel Landa, you know, on the climbs, on the stage two, which you attacked quite early, and I think a lot of people thought that when you were caught you might struggle to stay with those guys. Did you surprise yourself there that you were able to stay with them?
Actually, yes. I didn't think that I would really compete in the very hard final with all best of the race, but when they came back, I took some rest, and that's why I could do a good sprint.
So what have you learned this week, you know, in particular going head-to-head with guys like Landa and Wout Poels?
I really learned that I put a very big step forward this winter, and I can compete uphill with the best of the world, and it's a nice surprise for me.
So what other races should we be looking out for you in the coming months?
The first real important race is Omloop het Nieuwsblad. It's already next week. It's the first time I do it, but with this condition I think I can be ambitious. And then it's Paris-Nice, also a really important race.
So we heard there from Tim Wellens, part two of the Tim Wellens interview, just after he confirmed his overall win at the Route del Sol, 36 years after his team boss Marc Sargeant won the race. He claimed, when I asked him about that Sargeant won the race twice. He's actually wrong on that. Sargeant only won the race once, but never mind, you can be forgiven that. But very, very good win by Tim Wellens. Before that, we heard from Science and Sport. Thank you very much to Science and Sport for their backing of the Cycling Podcast. And you can get 25% off your Science and Sport products with the code SISCP25 at scienceandsport.com. And before that, we heard, of course, from Chris Froome, but we discussed that a little bit, didn't we, Fran, in part one? There's been a lot of chat about Chris Froome. All the riders have been asked about Chris Froome. It must be a bit annoying that when you've got your own race to focus on. But Tim Wellens has been pretty forthright. He like a lot of riders, I think, feels it'd be better if Froome hadn't been riding, but we are where we are. Froome, as he told us, will go on now to Tirreno Adriatico. But it's a bit of movement in the overall. Mikel Landa dropped down to 6th overall. Marc Soler, his new teammate at Movistar, moved up to 3rd overall. Good performance by him. He's still a young rider, isn't he? You know him very well, don't you, Fran?
Yeah, he rode for my amateur team back in the day. Pretty big engine above all, you know. It's like he's, from a technical point of view, he lacks a lot of skills. And he has a lot to evolve yet in the intangible side of the sport. Yet his engine is so big, his body is so well suited both for climbing and for the flat terrain that he's touted as a future GC contender at Grand Tours. And honestly, I believe that he can do it. And this and what he did on this Vuelta Andalucía, hanging on every stage and then doing a very good time trial in order to position himself in the podium, makes me believe that he is actually going to be a great contender.
An important result for him. I wonder how Mikel Landa will regard his week. You know, he's in a team where Alejandro Valverde seems back to his best. He won this race last year. Valverde, you may well have won it this week. He's so consistent, so good at winning. Landa, there's a lot of pressure on him, isn't there? Because he's in a team with three leaders for the Grand Tours, Nairo Quintana as well. So he may be a little bit disappointed. Just before we discuss him, I did speak to him very briefly at the finish. Sorry for the background noise, it was very noisy. But about his team, the Euskadi Foundation team, because Landa has stepped in to save that team. He effectively runs it. And I just wanted to ask him what it was like being here with his own team, riding in the race. Here is Mikel Landa at the finish. How it felt like this week having your own team, the Euskadi Foundation team, in the race as well.
It's beautiful, no, to see your boys, no, racing with you. You can help them closer, no, and I think it's been helpful for them.
Did you speak to them much during the race?
Yeah, I helped them, no, to take in the breakaway, to give them some advices.
This is the first step for them, but is the plan to develop that team and have it return maybe to the level that Euskaltel was at a few years ago?
We don't know. That's very, very difficult. Now, for me, it was very important to save the team, save Fundación Euskadi, and we will see, no, if we have an opportunity to become bigger.
So Mikel Landa there, talking about a team that he now runs, as you pointed out as we were listening to that, Fran, a team that he used to ride for as well.
Yeah, Fundación Euskadi is actually the entity that ran the former Euskaltel Euskadi team that was racing the Tour de France, orange-colored outfit, was 8 years part of the World Tour. But after Euskaltel pulled out of the sponsorship of the team, this entity had fallen somehow in a crisis. They stepped down to continental level, then to amateur level again. They were one of the best amateur teams in Spain, but still not professional as they used to be. But last summer, Mikel Landa gently called responsible of this Euskadi Foundation and took on the reins. They stepped up to the continental level. The plan is to mount even further next year to professional level. And what I understand is that in 2020 they want to rise even further and make one big, very strong, vast team. You know, there is even the possibility, as Landa contract expires in 2019 with Movistar team, that he might rejoin the team in 2020.
Well, that would seem the logical thing to do, wouldn't it? He's very proud Basque, and it's an interesting scenario at Movistar because, you know, they need. He's also the one of the real big Spanish stars at the moment, so it was also logical that he would join Movistar. But how's it going to shake out this year between him, Valverde, and Quintana? Because I don't think any of them are that keen to ride the Giro. They all seem to want to ride the Tour de France. Mm-hmm. What's going to happen? It looks like he might have jumped from the frying pan into the fire. And, you know, there is a scenario that could unfold whereby Chris Froome, if his process with the salbutamol suddenly progresses and Froome is served with a ban, you know, Froome might miss the Tour de France, and that sky would go without an obvious leader. And had Landa just stayed where he was, he might have well led that team into the race.
First things first, I have to say that idiom of jumping from the frying pan into the fire is great. Never
Why
heard that.
You yeah, never heard that?
I've never heard that, and it made me laugh a lot. So I'm going to keep that one in my pocket to throw it out at some point in my life. But other than that, with the Movistar thing, there is actually one of the riders of the 3 days of Movistar that wants to ride the Giro Italia, and that's Alejandro Valverde.
Sorry, he wants to ride the Giro and the Vuelta, doesn't he?
He wants to. In his real goal of this season is to win the World Championships in Innsbruck. He knows that this is one of the of his last shots to get the rainbow jersey, and being the mountainous route that helped his chances really dramatically. The thing is that that Eusebio Unzue knows that the real core and soul of Movistar team is Valverde, and I am not only speaking from a sporting point of view, I am also speaking from the point of view of the group. When he's not on the team, you can notice that the performance is way worse, especially team wise. He is really great at keeping the group glued together, and if he is not on the race, on the Tour de France, the Eusebio Unzue is afraid that they are going to miss him as much as they did last summer. Also, there is a second factor, and that's the cobbled stage. They know that Nairo Quintana and Mikel Landa have never ridden on the cobbles, and they don't know whether they can manage to race there properly, if they can survive to that cobbled stage. Whereas Alejandro Valverde has already proven some consistency on that terrain. And so because of that, they will probably bring all three guys to the Tour de France. Now, how are they going to settle between themselves? How are they going to manage that situation of having three leaders? Movistar historically has a tradition of having several leaders at Grand Tours and then let the road decide, as the cycling idiom goes. So they will probably do that. How will that work is really an unknown.
Let the road decide. That's never very reassuring, that is. I remember Johan Bernal saying that before the Tour de France in 2009 when he had Alberto Contador and Lance Armstrong, and that worked out well, didn't it? Let the road decide. I love it. What else from this week then, Fran? Tim Wellens, an impressive winner, an impressive guy. You know, he's a strong rider, still quite young, still 26. Not a typical Belgian rider. He's good at these week-long stage races. You would think he was asked in the press conference afterwards whether Flèche Wallonne might be a race that he fancies. You know, that you can't really compare the climb to the finish yesterday with Flèche Wallonne, because that was much shorter, and it was cobbled. Yeah. The Mur de Huy is longer. It's far more of a lung buster, and there are some real specialists in that race. But you know, Liège-Bastogne-Liège, he's ridden quite well in Amstel Gold Race before as well. He's a very versatile rider, and that's almost a curse in a way, because you know, he can win week-long stage races like this, but it's difficult to know what races he should really be targeting.
Yeah, I mean, he is even going to race on the cobbles next week. He told us that he was going to race the Oplandhede Nieuwsblad, which for me is really surprising, because we've never seen him excel on that kind of terrain, on that kind of classic. In any case, what impresses me most, or what calls my attention most, is the fact that he's great at the beginning of the season, great at the end of the season, but in the middle part, his performance are worse, you know. And he admits that, and he makes a case out of that. Like, he knows that happens, and he doesn't know why.
Well, at the Tour last year, he's problems sometimes with allergies and things, doesn't he?
Yeah.
So, and famously last year at the Tour de France, he didn't take a TUE in order to be able to carry on at the Tour, and had to pull out. MPCC rules also would have dictated that he wouldn't have been able to take a TUE, I think. Am I right
yeah,
in thinking
yeah,
that?
Sure.
And so you know, but that was that's something that seems to hamper him in the high summer. But he's a very talented rider and a very refreshing talker as well. You know, he is always quite straight, and he's, as I said earlier, he's had some strong opinions about Froome riding this week, as strong as they get. And he, you know, he didn't think he should be riding, and you know, perhaps among a majority of riders here, just because it detracts from the race as much as anything else, and it's not a great situation for anybody. Somebody, another young rider I spoke to in
the very stunning start in Sevilla on the penultimate day was young James Shaw, 21 years old now, rider from Nottingham in England, who joined the Lotto Soudal for last season. He featured quite heavily in our friend's special at the start of last year, where Lionel Burney went to the training camp in Mallorca with Lotto Soudal, and he just signed as a neopro and very candid about his fears and his expectations and his nervousness going into his debut season. He established himself. He's a strong rider. He's ridden well this week. But I spoke to him yesterday, and he did have something to get off his chest, because as a 21-year-old, second year of his contract, he should maybe be thinking about possibly being in contention for a Grand Tour, maybe the Vuelta this year. But with the reduction in the team sizes, that's going to be very, very difficult for him and for other riders like him. Here's what he had to say about all that in Sevilla. You feel at the end of the year with the team, did you talk about, you know, how you'd got on and what you were going to do this year in your second year?
Yeah, we had like a debrief. And then at the beginning of this year, we had a brief, spoke over a few things and tried to put a bit of a plan in place. But now with World Tour races and Grand Tours going down to 8 riders and things like that, obviously it all gets very difficult into, you know, who's going to go to races and stuff. So we're sort of working to try and sort of incorporate that into making sure that everybody gets a fair and even opportunities throughout the year.
So what does that plan look like this year?
Here? Go home for a bit of training, and then possibly Catalonia, Pays Basque, them sort of races, and then plan again from there, really, see if the legs are good enough to tackle bigger things, possibly. I like to hope so, but obviously, yeah, like I said, with races now being 8 riders, it all becomes very difficult for younger riders to get into progressive races and to move on. You know, it's made it a whole lot more difficult for neo-professionals and younger riders to actually get into big races. You know, teams are still taking those top 8 guys, and instead of taking a one young rider to develop or maybe two to develop, they're now saying, all right, well, can't take anybody to develop at all, we've got to take the A team. And there's so many good riders now that there's more than 8 top level riders per team. It's all, you know, it's come very hard for younger riders to get stuck into those races.
It's an interesting point. I mean, you know, Vuelta would have been a great development Grand Tour for a rider like you. Is that something you've got your sights set on this year? It will be difficult, as you say, with just 8 men per team.
Yeah, that almost be something I'd want to do, you know, almost something I'd like to think I could aim for. But like I say, 8 riders, you know, in always one, the top GC guys or some sprinter guys want to prepare for the Worlds, they maybe just want to go and do 10 days, so they take up a place and things like that. That actually, if you're a younger developing rider, you miss those opportunities where 9 riders, they're quite big teams, you know. For me, all becoming 8 riders, all it's done, the top 8 guys still get to go. If you're lower down the pecking order, you get shoved off, sort of thing. For me, I think it's just made it harder as well. I think you say it like, oh, it's only one rider per team. One rider, what difference is one rider? But actually, over all teams in all races, adds up to a lot of places. You know, even if, okay, there's 3 tours and things, 3 grand tours and things like that. You know, if you take one guy out of each per team, soon it's 200 opportunities less for a younger developing rider. And
teams need to know you can ride over 3 weeks, but you can't prove to them that you can ride over 3 weeks unless you get the opportunity.
Yeah, unless you get the opportunity to ride over 3 weeks, of course, you know. So, yeah, ultimately, though, the sport now is getting so big, so professional, so fast, so aggressive racing, that everybody's constantly getting better. You know, adding something like that, it's even more difficult, as if cycling wasn't hard enough already. So
I guess a World Tour race like Catalonia is important for you to prove what you can do at that level.
Yeah, exactly. I'd like to go to Catalonia and you know, I want to go there with a good form to prove to the team that I can ride for 1 week good, and the hope that they'll give me a bit of faith to, you know, progress and things like that. But we'll see. Got to get through today and tomorrow first.
The Rafa Cycling Club is the largest global community of its kind. Members share their passion for the road through rides, events, exclusive club kits and racing. Find out more at rafa.cc.
Yeah, I'm about to go.
You want to get home to get a copy of the book, don't you?
Yeah, I hear there's one waiting in the mail.
Tell us, Joe, what's in your chapter?
It's a bit about, I suppose, the model of professional cycling and I think the shortcomings of it and how unstable it is.
And it tells the story of what happened during the Vuelta last year.
Yeah, it was quite a dramatic couple weeks, but here we are.
And have you enjoyed the week here?
Yeah, it's been good. First race back, we got a stage win and we've got a bit of a sprint lead out that's sort of meshing together well, so it's been...
Does it make those kind of long flat stages more fulfilling for you? You've got a proper job to do.
Yeah, lots of time pulling on the front, so it's been good.
Great, well, you've got a flight to catch. You better ride quick, yeah, but not too quick that you're in the hot seat.
Exactly.
Good luck.
See ya.
Cheers. Thank you very much indeed to Rafa, our main sponsor. We are very grateful for them. I keep dropping my phone in the sand here, Fran, I'm sure.
Your phone just likes the beach, you know, more than you do.
It's like Chiro. I'm starting calling my phone Chiro, I think. It keeps making a bid for freedom. We're sitting on the beach now. It's absolutely beautiful. This part of Spain, it's all shut down at this time of year, but it's my favourite part of the year here. It's a nice temperature. It's early 20s. It's sunny. And yet none of the hotels and very few of the restaurants are open. Before we go on too much about that, I should say we were played in there by Joe Dombrowski. We heard a bit from Joe Dombrowski. Now, Joe, the Education First rider, had an interesting challenge today because he was off quite early. He had an early flight to catch. And so he had to ride the time trial hard enough that he wasn't outside the time limit, but not so hard that he was in the hot seat because he would have then missed his flight. He literally had to finish the race and then leave. I had a quick chat with him about that. And he mentioned also the chapter that he's written for our forthcoming book, which is published on March the 1st. One should be waiting for you at home when you get home, Fran, because you are also a contributor to the book, A Journey Through the Cycling Year. Tell us about your chapter. Well, you've written a diary from the Vuelta. We've all kept diaries from the Vuelta. You covered, I think, the second week. Yeah. But you've also written a chapter.
Yeah, a chapter about Alberto Contador, his fairy tale ending, and also about how his stopping case helped his public image in Spain, you know, and how good his story reflects the philosophy that is somehow embedded within the Spanish spirit.
It's an excellent read, and your diary is very entertaining too. We've got contributions from, as I said, Joe Dombrowski, Ashley Mulman-Passio has written a chapter as well, and other friends of the podcast like Chiro Scogna-Emilio, Seb Piquet, Francois Tomazo. Hopefully people enjoy it. It's out on March the 1st, A Journey Through the Cycling Year. And to coincide with the publication of the book, we're doing a tour of venues throughout the UK, starting in, well, we're not throughout the UK, as has been pointed out to us more than once, but we start in in Salford, at the Lowry Theatre in Salford. Then we go on to Edinburgh, to Glasgow. Those dates are the 28th of February, 1st of March and 2nd of March. Following week, it's Nottingham, Hackney, Leeds and Sheffield from the 7th to the 10th of March. Details and tickets at thecyclingpodcast.com if you go into live events. We hope to see as many of you there as possible. Tickets have been selling really well, but there are still tickets available for all venues, one or two of them very close to being sold out, though, so do get your tickets soon, and we're looking forward to that. It's a combination of us taking part in those events. Fran, you took part in an event with us at the end of last year in London. That was good fun. Maybe you'll join us again in November when we're planning another little mini tour. Who knows?
Good.
Keep it free.
Yeah, of course. My whole month of November is free for you.
Excellent, excellent. Well, as I say, we heard from Joe Dombrowski and his team, Education First, Drapac, powered by Cannondale. Is that correct?
I think so, yeah. I mean, I still struggle to think of the name of the team. You know, usually I go with Cannondale.
What do you think of their kit?
I love it.
What will they wear at the Giro?
I hope they keep the same kit.
Will they be allowed to wear pink?
I don't think so. I mean, after all, there is some rule out there that makes them change the kit if it coincides with the Grand Tour leader jersey. But so if they enforce that rule, they will have to change it.
There's a lot of white in there as well, but maybe they'll change to their orange kit that's a training kit. Who knows? Yeah. That remains to be seen. If so, Joe Dombrowski will be wearing it because he's down to ride the Giro again. But one of the interesting takeaways from this week has been the Education First team, because they've come into the season with a new focus on sprinting. They've got Sasha Modolo and Dan McClay, and you know, if you have sprinters in the team, you really have to win, and winning has been a bit of a problem for that team the last couple of years. And they've got off the mark with Sascha Modolo. He went very close on stage one, threw his hands in there, but actually had just lost out to Thomas Bouda, Frenchman. But he made amends for that on stage four, when he was a pretty comfortable winner after a lot of good work from the team, including Joe. He spent a lot of time on the front for the first 100 or so kilometres. And then, you know, he had some strong classics riders at the end, like Sepp van Marck, Sebastian Langeveld, Matty Breschel, people like that, to help out. So a pretty strong team here, and they'll be pretty happy with the stage win. I spoke to Charlie Wigelius, the sports director, after the stage that Sascha Modolo won, just to ask him about that new focus this year. Here's what Charlie Wigelius had to say. Charlie, did you get a good view of what happened there in the finale? You know, who was particularly helpful for Sascha Modolo there?
To be honest, you know, the TVs and the cars, they have this habit of cutting out about 900 metres to go, regardless of where you are. But we still saw pretty good. I think Matty Breschel was in there, did a great job. But the final in the end, I know, that went downhill like that, that was pretty important. So the important work was done a little bit earlier before the roundabout there.
Obviously disappointing the other day when he narrowly lost out. And it's so important, isn't it? I know that there's an emphasis in the team this year on sprinting with Modolo and Dan McLeay.
Yep.
But it's important to get an early win, isn't it? You know, for confidence and just to prove it can be done.
Yeah, I think sprinters are a lot like strikers in soccer or in football, you know. That if they're on a good run and they keep the mojo going, then everything's good. And if you go a long period without things clicking, then you start to second guess what you're doing and so on. So it's nice to make a good start.
It's a new look, a new sponsor. Does it feel almost like a new team?
No, I think it's the same philosophy and the same mentality. A lot of the backroom staff is, you know, totally unchanged, so I think the spirit's the same. But this whole approach with sprinting is something a bit new for us. So.
And what sort of other races can Sascha Modolo target? Is it going to be stages and week-long stage races, Grand Tours as well, obviously, but what you know, what sort of other races can he target, do you think?
I mean, we brought him here because it's quite a hard race, and I think he's somebody who, although he's quick, he can get over hills, and you shouldn't forget that he's also, you know, finished in the top 10 and 6th in Flanders and so on. So he manages to ride his bike, and he can do well in the classics and these kind of harder medium stages. I think he's a pretty good rider for those situations.
So Gent-Wevelgem or something like that could be within his grasp, do you think?
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, he knows his way around Belgium, and he's got some great teammates now, along with Sepp and Langeveld and so on, that can, you know, maybe accelerate that for him.
Charlie Wigelius, they're happy and relieved, I would think, because if you sign sprinters, you really have to win. Pretty smart move bringing Sascha Modolo here, because, you know, on paper, he was one of the most proven sprinters, I suppose. There weren't a lot of top sprinters here. But, you know, a win is a win. Most of the sprinters are in the desert, and riding in Oman, and Alexander Kristoff won out there today, and Abu Dhabi coming up. So a very kind of varied field here, you know, from you know, a huge spectrum of abilities, really. And it was, I think, a pretty smart move on their part to bring Sascha Modolo here and just give him that win that he'll take a lot from that, and the team will take a lot from that.
Yeah, I was speaking to Charlie Wigelius myself on the eve of the first stage, because I was pretty interested on how they tried to work as a treno in the Vuelta a la Comunidad Valenciana, but didn't quite manage to do it because of crashes and bad luck, and they repeated more or less the same lineup here. So speaking to him, you know, one could see that this is a very smart move, because they took the opportunity to sign a couple of very big sprinters that I would say they were underrated, because they were in teams that maybe didn't have very very talented or very compact trains to work for them, and for a team that usually struggles to get victories, especially in a world tour, in the world tour level, such as the former Cannondale, now Education team, Education First team, it makes a lot of sense. Also, Wigelius told me that nowadays he perceives that races tend to finish with bigger groups than before, because cyclists are more well-rounded, more complete. All cyclists in general are coping better with the climbing efforts. So if the sprint, like the first stage of the Ruta del Sol, say, that usually 20 years ago would finish with a group of 50 men, maybe. Now finishes with 100. A lot of sprinters can be in the mix, and why not EF sprinters?
Education first.
Education first, EF,
Drapac, powered by Cannondale.
Education first, EF, Drapac, powered by Cannondale.
We're not allowed to call them EF, apparently. It's got to be Education First, EF, or EF Education First.
Not allowed. Education First Police.
Education First Police. Nino. Anything else from this week? One thing, Fran, I've been calling this race the Ruta del Sol throughout. That's its old name. It's called the Vuelta a Andalucía now. Which do you prefer?
Actually, it's hard to know which way to call this race, because in theory, this is the Vuelta a Andalucía. This has been the Vuelta a Andalucía for a while, for a long time since its inception. Thing is that the organizers of the race don't want to call it Vuelta a Andalucía because they are still expecting to get some sponsorship and some stages in other places of the south of Spain. You know, they've had stages in Murcia, they have stages in Melilla, in Ceuta, and even in Gibraltar, which in theory is yours, but actually is ours. And that's why they don't want to call it Vuelta Andalucía. Even the hashtag of the race is RDS, yeah, as Ruta del Sol, but still the Twitter handle is Vuelta Andalucía. So who knows?
So it was originally Vuelta Andalucía.
Yes.
So, but in the 80s, you know, when I started following cycling, it was always the Ruta del Sol.
Yeah, because they changed it because they wanted to include the stages in Valencia and Murcia.
So the Ruta del Sol came later.
Later. Oh, okay. Yeah. So nowadays, we can call it both ways. They also, I mean, even if the Andalusian government sponsors the race, every year they give a bit less money to the race. And the organizers are increasingly more upset with them. Okay. So that's why they don't want to speak a lot of Andalucía and rather call this race Ruta del Sol.
Interesting. Well, it is a stunning part of Spain, and as I said earlier, I can't understand why there aren't more people, why there isn't more tourism here at this time of year, because to me this is far more pleasant than the height of summer here, because it gets too hot, does it not?
Yeah, it gets too hot, but also the beach gets too nice, you know. So it's a lovely place of Spain to visit in any part of the year. Last year I was here myself after the Tour de France for a weekend with a friend, and it was lovely. There is a lot of good party in the side of Cadiz, in the Atlantic Ocean coast, and also in this part of the year it is quiet, it is lovely, and the food is always great.
What I like about this race as well, Fran, is that we do see a real varied collection of riders. There are some riders whose goals are the big stage races later in the year. We've had a few classics riders here as well, honing their form. And Tim Wellens sort of falls in between somewhere. You know, he is a rider who can win big races, but we're not quite sure, you know, what would be the pinnacle for Tim Wellens, I think. And maybe he doesn't know himself yet. Yeah. But a couple of the classic specialists who've been here, Oliver Nassen, the Belgian champion, rides for AG2R, and Sepp van Mark, who obviously rides for Education First. Two Belgian riders, big, strong Belgian riders. Van Mark, in particular, looks in great shape. He kind of always looks in great shape. He's lean, he's muscular, but he's given himself a pretty hard week here. He was out off the front for a lot of the penultimate stage, working hard. So he looks in good shape. He's been in great shape before for the Het Nieuwsblad in particular, and has often suffered bad luck. I had a quick chat with him just after Sacha Modelo's stage win, and I spoke to Oliver Nassen at the start in Sevilla. Let's hear first from Sepp van Mark and then from Oliver Nassen. Very satisfying day today, I imagine.
Yeah, for sure. 2 days ago we were working for a sprint and for the win, of course, and that didn't work out. We were really close, and now we kept confidence. He's one of the fastest, I think, here, and we worked again really hard. John Dombrowski rode the whole day, then Sebastian Langeveld pulled also. And then, we were missing a guy with Tom van Asbroek for the lead out, but yeah, we timed really well with the four of us that were left, and it was perfect.
And what about you? You're obviously looking ahead to a couple of weeks and Het Nieuwsblad, I guess, as your first big personal target for the year.
Yeah, for sure. The first classic race in Belgium is always important. There's a lot of attention. Everybody wants to show their good on the cobbles, and So of course, we also hope to be good.
You have been in great shape in these races before, but you've had an awful lot of bad luck over the years, especially when you've seemed to be going really, really well. You look to be in good shape at the moment. How would you compare your condition to previous years?
It's always hard to compare. It's first time I do Ruta del Sol. But actually, more or less like every year, I feel good, and I think I'm at least in the same shape.
Looking ahead to these races, I've asked you this before, but of the two big ones, Flanders and Roubaix, which is the one that you kind of fancy most?
Oh, it's difficult because as my nature, I think Paris-Roubaix suits me even more, but because I'm a Belgian and I'm from Flanders, of course this race is also extremely important for me, so I put them on the same level.
You're looking ahead, of course, to the big races a bit north of here in Belgium.
Yeah.
How's the form ahead of those races?
Form is good. I was just a little bit sick this week, but apart from that, everything's as planned, as hoped for.
Similar shape to last year, because you were very strong in those races last year.
I think I'm a little bit better now than last year in this period. I mean, I hope at least, and the tests I did also say I'm a little bit better. And I hope the results in the classics are also a tad higher.
And the team, a couple of new signings, guys who might be, you know, strong helpers or strong riders themselves in those races. Are you going there with a team that's more focused on those races now?
Yeah, absolutely. When I first came in the team, so last year, we went to the classics, hoping to take some points to maybe snatch a top 10 here and there, but not like to be amongst the best ones. It was a bit of an eye-opener last year for me and for the team. So they signed some really strong names, and it's still a Tour de France team, but it has become one of the bigger goals.
There's a real focus on those races now for the team.
Absolutely, there's so much to win with the World Tour point system. So even for the French now, it's important.
Which of these races coming up is the one that you would most like to win? You were right to the fore in Tour of Flanders last year, of course, and you had that terrible incident with the jacket and all the rest of it. Do you think back to that a lot? I mean, what might have been, and is that the race that really excites you most?
Yeah, sure. I think of it a lot of time. I think of it all the time almost. And normally, I think it would have been a podium, which would have been incredible. And I hope to do it this year. That's my main goal of the season, actually.
Flanders is the one that you really want.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm not saying I'm going to win it one day, but that's a dream at least.
And your brother is a professional now as well. How's he getting on?
He was already last year with Ferrand Classic, and now he's with Lotto. So he's in Algarve now, working for the team. He says he feels good. I hope for him it's true, because it's been a long time since I've seen him with the different race programs and training camp programs. I think I've trained with him once since New Year's, so I'm not sure about his shape. He says it's good, but...
Is he a similar type of rider to you? He's a big, big, strong-looking rider.
He's the same type. He's a bit younger. He started racing very, very late, only as the last year under 23. He only took up bike racing as last year under 23, so I think he has a lot of margin still.
Sepp van Marck and Oliver Nassen, they're looking ahead to the cobbled classics. Both are capable of winning any of these races, but Nassen suffered terrible luck last year when he was involved in the crash with Peter Sagan towards the end of the Tour of Flanders, once Philippe Gilbert was away. And Sepp van Marck had a number crash. He had a terrible crash in the Tour of Flanders, actually. His wheel seemed to get caught in one of these gaps in the road, the concrete roads in Belgium, yeah, with the sections, and he seemed to get caught out, and he came off very, very heavily. I think Luke Rowe came off from that crash as well. Nassen is an interesting rider who's got stronger and stronger and has a team now that is much stronger as well for these races. And, you know, it seems odd to be going from the sunshine here in the south of Spain up to cold Belgium, but that's exactly what I'm going to be doing. I'm going up to Het Nieuwsblad, so I'll be there next week. And for a lot of people, especially Lionel Burney, that's when the season properly begins. No disrespect to the Ruta del Sol.
Can I go with you?
If you want.
Nah, actually, I'm covering a small Spanish under 23 race next weekend. I think I fancy it better.
But do you look forward to what do the cobble classics mean in Spain? I mean, there's been the odd Spanish rider, Juan Antonio Fletcher, of course, who's loved these races. He won Het Nieuwsblad, didn't he, in 2010, I remember. But what do they mean to Spanish cycling fans?
Spanish cycling fans love cobbled classics, you know. I mean, of course, those who are really cycling fans, you know, for the casual fan, the casual observer, they usually go only with Grand Tours. And as for the riders, there has been quite a shift, because 20 years ago, going to the Cobalt Classics was a punishment for those who had started the season in bad shape, or a treat that was reserved for neo-pros on their first year on the as professionals. Whereas right now, there are a handful of riders that actually like Cobalt Classics. Especially there is one, Ivan García Cortina, who is kind of a Spanish Peter Sagan, racing now for Bahrain Merida. A really strong engine within that body, and a quite amazing personality as well. So look out for him, because in a couple of this year he's going to be out there, and in a couple of years he's going to be contending for victories.
Alejandro Valverde riding Tour of Flanders. He's hinted at it in the past. Is he going to ride this year?
Oh, every year the same question is asked. Every year the same answer is given. We'll see. And we see that he's not rising.
No, but what do you think this year? Because again, I've heard it said this year. It's been suggested this year.
Maybe this is giving too much away, but
what we're all about.
What I understand from all my friends that are racing in Movistar, they don't know their racing schedule ahead of April. They only know until Volta a Catalunya. From Volta a Catalunya on, they don't know what is going to happen.
Excellent. Well, Fran, thanks for it. That's you, blacklisted by Movistar. Thanks very much for joining us this week on the Cycling Podcast. I'll be back next week with Daniel Freib and Lionel Burney again. Our little reminder, we've got the Cycling Podcast Femina coming out in the next... it might well be out already, actually, by the time this is released. It's coming out this week with myself, Orla Shinawee, and Rose Manley. We've got an interview with Lisa Brenner, and we've got an interview with about the new Movistar women's team, which is your story, Fran. And we've also got a friend special coming out this week. That is Orla Shinawee's trip to the Isle of Man. Become a friend of the podcast at thecyclingpodcast.com. It's £15 for the year. And we're very grateful to all of you who have signed up, and hope you're enjoying what we're offering behind our paywall. Thank you. And also thank you to you, Fran. Hope to see you on the road again soon.
Soon. In the road, in the cobbles, on the sterrato.
You've been listening to the Cycling Podcast. Follow us on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter and YouTube to keep up with all the latest news and special offers from us. Just search online for the Cycling Podcast. This episode was edited and produced by John Mooney.